You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 27th of December, 1921. As described in the previous lecture, imaginative cognition can be attained by one's lifting into consciousness what is happening subconsciously and involuntarily in dreaming. To put it more precisely, it is not the dreaming itself with its inherent dream content which is lifted into consciousness, for if this were to happen, we should remain in the realm of unreality, but the activity underlying it. For the moment I shall not define what this activity, going on while we are dreaming, entails. It is this activity, lifted into consciousness by controlled will power, which becomes the basis for imaginative cognition. And this conscious activity is of a very different kind from that of dreaming. For in the latter, just because we are not active participants, we are under the impression that our experiences represent reality. However, if we lift our dream-producing activity into consciousness, we realize only too well that we are seeing images of our own making. It is this awareness which saves us from becoming victims of hallucinations, instead of working as investigators of spiritual science. This first meditative activity of creating images must now be superseded by a second step, which consists in obliterating these images, thus leading to an emptied consciousness. If one has been able, in full consciousness and under full control, to enhance one's soul powers in this way, one has in fact entered the spiritual world. One is then able to engage in an activity which, being of soul and spirit only, is independent of the physical body. One no longer perceives with physical organs. While one's thinking becomes freed from the body, one is able consciously to experience content of a purely spiritual nature. Yesterday I pointed out that for an anthroposophical investigator, dreamlike experiences are not to be looked upon as a model for spiritual perception. Only fully controlled experiences, similar to those characteristic of our sense perceptions, are valid. Obviously, there is no possibility for sense perceptions in supersensible cognition. Nevertheless, we can look upon the freedom with which we move when surrounded by our sense perceptions, and upon the independence from our personal makeup during the act of perceiving, as upon a definite capacity. An example will make my meaning clear. Let us look at one of our most characteristic and representative sense organs, the human eye, EYE. Already, by the way in which it rests in its cavity, attached to the remaining organism by quite insubstantial links, we can recognize the relative independence of this organ. Leaving alone for the moment what happens in the act of seeing, we can find another more external process also taking place. Near the eye are the lacrimal glands, which during our waking state continually secrete a liquid, mainly composed of salt water. This liquid flushes the eyeball, and also the part which is exposed to the outside air when the eye is open. Through this glandular activity, the eye is constantly bathed, so that any dust particles entering the eye from the outside are washed away through tear ducts entering the nose. This process, which forms part of the normal function of our organ of sight, is hidden from ordinary consciousness. Now, this wisely ordained but completely unconscious activity of the lacrimal glands can be accelerated by stimulus of various kinds, by pressure, cold, and so on, or through the exhaustion of the eye and the organism in general. The lacrimal glands then become more active, and the cause of their secretion, as well as the secretion of tears itself, begins to enter our consciousness. However, a further increase of this activity may come about in quite a different way. If some sad event makes us weep, tears flow as a result of a purely emotional stress, or because our feelings have been deeply moved. Here we see how, under normal circumstances, the lacrimal liquid is constantly being secreted in complete unconsciousness, and how outer irritants will lead to an increase in consciousness of this activity. But when a person weeps because of some soul distress, this lacrimal activity is lifted into the sphere of consciousness only through soul or moral issues, and not through any physical causes. Such a simple fact can help to illustrate what happens when, through meditation, one is able to lift oneself into a body-free state of consciousness, in which one is able to live entirely in soul and spiritual experiences. If you shed tears because you receive a letter which makes you unhappy, you must admit that the cause of your tears has nothing to do with your physical eyes. Nevertheless, it affects your physical eyes. The fact that the tears are not connected with your actually reading the letter can easily be proved if someone else is reading the letter to you with the same tearful consequences. Something non-physical has set an organic process in motion. Now, suppose that you have gained such mastery over yourselves that you are able to suffer great sorrow without shedding any tears. This does not imply that the anguish is less intense than when you weep. In that case, your soul experiences do not directly affect your bodily functions. This example may illustrate how, through self-training, one can achieve a state of soul and spirit which has become emancipated from the physical organism. It may help you to form some conception of how imagination, inspiration, and intuition, as methods of spiritual science, can open the gates into the supersensible world. If you take the proper steps, you will then be able to describe experiences from beyond the tapestry of the senses, experiences which may be looked upon as an enhanced continuation of what the ordinary person experiences in normal life. This, however, is only possible through the practice of specific exercises of a soul and spiritual nature. If now, by continued spiritual training, you have reached the stage where you can suppress previous imaginations of your own creating, and if in the ensuing stage of emptied consciousness, you, nevertheless, are able to experience real soul and spiritual content, the first thing which will come to meet you is a tableau-like picture of your earth life, approximately from birth up to the present moment. You will not be able to see your own physical body in that picture, for that vanishes away when you have reached body-free perceiving. But everything you have experienced, everything which belongs to the stream of your memory, which normally remains unconscious and out of which only separate images rise up from time to time, stands there before you to meet your soul. It confronts you as an entity, as a kind of time organism, which is full of its own inner movement. If you look at the physical body as it appears in space, you will find that its various members are dependent on one another, together making up the whole. What happens in the head has a certain relationship with the stomach, and vice versa. Everything that happens in an organism is interrelated. The same is also true for an organism existing in time. Later happenings depend on earlier happenings. The past lives in the present. At such a moment, you are suddenly confronted by the totality of your life tableau. If one's ability to suppress, in full consciousness, the tableau of one's memory pictures, that is, if not only one's body but the entire life tableau has vanished away, one reaches the stage in which experiences prior to birth, or rather prior to one's conception, are revealed. The realm of soul and spirit which one inhabited before entering this earthly existence remains part of one's inner being, also during life on earth. It works and lives in us, in a similar way in which hydrogen lives together with oxygen when these two elements form water. But just as one cannot examine hydrogen separately from the oxygen while it forms the compound water, so one cannot examine separately the soul and spiritual part of man while he lives on earth. Just as the oxygen first has to be isolated out of the water before one can examine the remaining hydrogen, so must the soul and spiritual part of man first become isolated. And when this happens, we are led not into the present time, but into our pre-earthly existence. In this way, one is really able to perceive what has descended from the spiritual world in order to take on earthly form. The realm in which we lived before entering earthly life becomes revealed to us. It is quite understandable if some people are not prepared to go to such lengths in order to be able to investigate the eternal part of man. Certainly everybody is free not to follow the paths here indicated. But to believe that it would be possible to examine man's soul and spiritual nature by ordinary methods of cognition would be like naively believing that one could examine hydrogen while it formed part of the compound water, without first isolating it. One has to realize that by means of ordinary consciousness, it is not possible to enter the realm of soul and spirit. If one is not prepared to accept the results of spiritual investigation, one will have to remain silent with regard to the supersensible world. In that case, one will have to be content with occupying oneself with the material side of existence only. The truth may well be irksome to some, but there are certain facts of life which one simply has to accept. Continuing this path of spiritual training, we gradually reach inspirational knowledge. We become inspired by something which does not normally enter our consciousness, but which permeates our being, as does the oxygen which we take in from the outer air in our breathing. In full consciousness, we are being filled with inspirational cognition, filled with the experience of our pre-earthly life. Just as in respiration, we are filled with material oxygen. We breathe in our soul and spiritual being, rising to the stage of inspiration. This name has not been chosen arbitrarily, but in keeping with the characteristic nature of this type of cognition. Inspirational cognition has yet another characteristic feature. You will find more about it in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment. In order to develop this higher cognition, one further faculty is necessary, namely that of presence of mind. It is the faculty that enables one to act spontaneously during a given life situation. In order not to miss the right moment, one may have to act without waiting until one has had time to judge the issue properly. One should really use such moments which life offers in order to become practiced in acting swiftly and decisively, in quickly grasping the moment, for whatever comes to us through inspiration passes as if in a flash. As soon as it makes its appearance, it has already vanished again. One needs to be able to catch such fleeting moments with the utmost attentiveness. When confronted with the ordinary sense world, it appears to you spread out in space. But if you are confronted by your own life tableau, you behold it as if existing in time. However, during inspirational cognition, one is outside the realm of time. One depends on being able to perceive in the flash of a moment. Time has lost its meaning. as soon as one experiences inspirational cognition. If one lives oneself into this life tableau, one finds there something far more real than the ordinary memory pictures can give us. The latter are neutral and lacking in inner strength. They are there and we are free to take them up, but in themselves they have no strength. What we meet when beholding our life tableau, on the other hand, is full of its own life and strength, containing the very forces which actually form the human being. These are supersensible, formative forces, which are active, for example, in forming the brain of a young child, before its final structure has been accomplished. It is these formative forces which one begins to recognize, for they are contained within this life tableau. One is not grasping something abstract, but a full reality, something which is encompassing the course of time, something that is full of strength. It is the refined, non-material body of forces, which we have also called the ether body or the body of formative forces. This body only momentarily presents a well-defined appearance in space, for it is in constant motion. If we were to try to paint a picture of it, we should be painting something unreal, because the ether body is in constant flux. Its subsequent stage would be quite different again, just as a former stage was totally different. This etheric body is a time organism through and through, and it lies at the basis of the growing processes and those forces active in a human metabolism. If one has advanced far enough in imaginative cognition, consciously to live in the realm of one's soul and spirit, which lies beyond the physical, and if one has progressed far enough to be able to behold one's own life tableau at will, that is, one's etheric body or body of formative forces, then one has truly experienced a complete transformation of one's cognitional life. One finds that what is experienced in this etheric world is both similar and yet very unlike what happens in the world of artistic activities. In order to experience it, one has to develop a more creative kind of thinking, which is so very different from any abstract, naturalistic thinking. Although in certain respects this kind of thinking resembles that of a creative artist, in other ways it is again quite different. For an artist's creations have to reach a certain finality within the realm of fantasy. His or her creativity remains bound to the physical. It is not freed from corporeality. But the activity practiced in imaginative cognition is entirely freed from the physical, and therefore is capable of grasping spiritual reality. For instance, when looking at the Venus of Milo, you will hardly have the feeling that this statue will begin to move and walk toward you. An artist's creation does not embody outer realities. If you saw the devil painted on a canvas, you would hardly feel afraid of his coming to fetch you. What matters is how the artist, bound to physical reality, deals with this material reality. But he does not dive into the reality of soul and spirit. What has been achieved in imaginative cognition, on the other hand, is immersed in ultimate reality, in the reality of spiritual processes. Now the objection may well be raised that pure cognition should be kept quite separate from the realm of artistic activities. It is easy to prove by logic that cognizing means moving from one conception to the next in logical sequence, and that if one enters the sphere of art, one is in fact transgressing the realm of cognition. One can argue for a long time about the laws of cognition. But if nature herself is an artistic creator, she will never reveal herself to mere logical thinking. Logic alone will never be able to reach her true being. Therefore, however much it can be proved by logic that cognizing must not be confused with being engaged in artistic activities, one will not be able to enter the reality of the etheric world without applying an artistic mode of cognizing. What matters is how the world is and not what the laws of our cognizing ought to be. Even if certain suppositions are logically tenable, they may nonetheless prevent us from reaching our goal. Therefore, it is right to maintain that an artistic element has to enter our efforts if we wish to raise our ordinary cognition to the level of imaginative cognition. When reaching the stage of inspiration, we can again compare our experiences with something which they resemble and yet from which they differ greatly, namely, experiences of a moral nature and the grasping of moral ideas. Viewed qualitatively, inspirations are similar to moral ideas. And yet they are totally different through the fact that any moral ideal, which we may have, in itself does not have the power of realizing itself by its own strength. In themselves, our moral ideals are powerless. We must make them effective through our own physical personality. We must put them into the world by means of our physical existence. Otherwise, they remain mere thoughts. But this cannot be said of an inspiration. Though qualitatively similar to moral ideas, to moral impulses, inspiration shows itself to be a reality, existing in its own right. It is a powerful force, which works as do the elemental forces in nature. And so one enters a world which one has to imagine as being similar to that of the world of moral idea, yet one that is a reality through its own primal power. If, having advanced far enough in reaching the stage of inspiration, one is able to take one's stand in the world of soul and spirit, then something else is still required in order to be able to experience its content. One has to carry something into this realm which does not at all exist in our abstract world of thoughts, namely, a complete devotion to one's chosen objective. It is not possible to learn to know a being or a power in the spiritual world unless one surrenders oneself lovingly and completely to what comes to meet one during the state of inspiration. At first, inspiration remains only a manifestation of the spiritual world. Its full inner nature reveals itself only if, with loving devotion, one pours oneself out into its own substance. And only after having experienced the reality of soul and spirit in this way, full of life and with heightened consciousness, has one entered the realm of inspiration. And this is already intuitive cognition. Shadow forms of intuition can be found in ordinary life, where they exist in religious feelings and in religious moods. However, a religious feeling remains a purely inward experience, which does not lift one up into outer spirituality. Intuition, on the other hand, is an experience of an objective spiritual reality. In this way, also intuition is similar, and yet again quite different from a purely religious experience. If one wishes to put down these degrees of higher knowledge in a more or less systematic order, one can say, first of all, in ordinary life, we have knowledge of the material world, which we could call naturalistic knowledge. Then we come to knowledge gained through imagination, which is of an artistic nature. The next step is knowledge attained through inspiration, which, in essence, is a moral one. Finally, we reach knowledge through intuition, which is akin to religious experiences, but only in the sense just characterized. Such supersensible experiences of an artistic, moral, and religious kind work upon and transform the whole human being. Even though ordinary consciousness knows nothing of them, they nevertheless form part of the human being. Therefore, supersensible cognition, as gained through imagination, inspiration, and intuition, enables us to know the whole human being. And because these powers, streaming from the spiritual world into earthly existence, work particularly strongly in the child, higher cognition especially enables us to understand the nature of the child. However, it is important to recognize how these supersensible forces are related to physical forces. This can be illustrated particularly well if we take memory as an example, because active memory definitely depends on the functioning of physical organs. Even quite commonplace experiences can demonstrate how our body has to play its part when we use our powers of memory. For instance, we may wish to memorize the part of a play or a poem, only to find that the lines simply refuse to become imprinted in our mind. Yet after having slept on them during the night, we may suddenly be able to remember them without much difficulty. This happens because during the night's sleep, our body has become regenerated, so that on the following morning we are able to use its renewed vitality for the task of remembering our lines. One can also prove anatomically and physiologically that through paralysis or separation of certain areas within the nervous system, specified areas of memory can be wiped out. In short, one can definitely see that memory is dependent on the functioning of the physical organization, and that physical organs are active during the process of remembering. However, this kind of memory activity is completely different from what is experienced in heightened consciousness through imagination, inspiration, and intuition. For supersensible experiences of this kind simply must not be involved in any way in the functioning of physical organs. This is the very reason why such experiences cannot be remembered in the ordinary way. They do not impress themselves into ordinary memory. Anyone engaged in anthroposophical research has to allow ordinary memory to run its course side by side with what he or she experiences supersensibly. Ordinary memory must remain intact. In a way, a student of anthroposophy has to keep his second personality, representing his ordinary life, always by his side. But he knows full well that there is this other, first personality in him which is engaged in supersensible knowledge, and which will not allow itself to become imprinted in the memory. In ordinary life we can retain only a memory picture of a fish we have seen, and not the actual fish itself. In supersensible cognition, one has direct perceptions, not mental images, and therefore one cannot carry them in one's memory. Consequently, one has to return to them time and time again. However, it is possible to remember what one has done in order to gain supersensible cognition, and if one repeats these efforts, supersensible beholding will re-emerge, albeit only passively. For it cannot live in the memory. It can only be attained through renewed inner activity. The fact that these higher faculties lie beyond the reach of memory is a characteristic feature of supersensible cognition. One can regain it, but only by following a route similar to the one traveled before. One is able to remember the path trodden previously, but not the supersensible experience itself. It is this fact which distinguishes supersensible experiences from ordinary ones. But one must point out, again and again, that a healthy memory must go parallel to true supersensible experiences. Anyone losing the stream of common memory while engaged in supersensible experiences would pour his or her subjective personality into them. In this case, he or she would not be a student of anthroposophical research, but someone living in hallucinations and personal visions. It is important to realize that all forms of hallucinations should be strictly excluded from supersensible cognition, and that the latter must be developed side by side with the normal and healthy life of the soul. Anyone remonstrating that imagination and inspiration gained through anthroposophy could equally well be mere hallucinations, does not know the characteristic properties of the anthroposophical path, and only talks out of ignorance. It is essential to recognize this difference between supersensible cognition and memory. Both are realities in human life. Supersensible substance, gained through imagination and inspiration, has its own separate existence, of which, through our own efforts, we can become aware. Memory, on the other hand, is not only the result of our own activity, for here our unconscious also plays its part. What we experience through imagination remains in the spiritual world. It is as if it came toward the human being and united with him, but memory streams right through him, entering the physical organization, making it participate. It penetrates the physical part of man. Comparing memory with imagination helps us to appreciate the difference between what is linked to our physical body and what lives in us as a supersensible force, everlastingly, also between birth and death. Because it escapes our ordinary consciousness, it has to be revealed through anthroposophical investigation. Only by immersing oneself into the relationship between the part of man's being, which can be experienced only supersensibly, and that of his physical existence, can one learn to know the entire human being. If one lives oneself into what supersensible knowledge reveals, one also learns to know the child, the growing human being, in a way which enables one to develop a true art of education. And the example of the relationship between the supersensible being of man and what is at work in memory can help to shed light on this problem. Now, let us suppose that a teacher were introducing a subject to a class. First, he or she would approach it in a more general way and might be under the impression that all was going well. But from a certain moment on, he might notice that one of the children in the class was getting paler and paler. Such pallor need not be of an obvious kind, and might easily have been passed unnoticed by anyone not trained in exact observation. A proper teacher, however, should always be fully aware of each pupil's condition. Symptoms which I am about to characterize could have manifold causes. But if a teacher has deepened his knowledge of man through anthroposophical training, he will have awakened and enhanced his ordinary pedagogical instincts to the extent of being able to diagnose and deal also with other causes. A science of education which lays down fixed and abstract rules would have a similar effect upon a practicing teacher as if he were constantly treading upon his own feet while trying to walk. It would rob him of all creative spontaneity. If he were always wondering how to apply rules prescribed by educational science, he would lose all ingenuity, all rightful pedagogical instincts. On the other hand, educational principles based on anthroposophy have quite the opposite effect. They do not let his inborn pedagogical sense wither away, but they enliven and strengthen his whole personality. This at least is the purpose of practical pedagogy springing from anthroposophy. Therefore, however varied outer symptoms may be, for life is full of surprises, a teacher whose pedagogical sense has been stimulated and sharpened by anthroposophy may suddenly realize, when seeing such a paling child, that he has overfed it with memory content. Naturally, there could be many other reasons for such a symptom, which a gifted teacher would also be able to discover. I am quoting this example to illustrate one of the fundamental tasks of anthroposophy, namely to make people aware of the mutual interaction between soul and spirit with what belongs to physical man and to the world of matter. Anthroposophy does not merely aim at revealing spirit knowledge, but above all, it endeavors to open the eyes of people to how the living spirit works and reveals itself in matter. Such knowledge will enable us to deal rightly with the practical problems of life. It will place us strongly into the world, in which we have to fulfill our tasks. If the pallor of a certain child, caused by the overburdening of the pupil's memory, is not recognized in time, a perceptive teacher will notice a further change in the child, this time of a psychological kind. The child will develop an anxiety complex. Such a symptom, again, may not be at all conspicuous, and would be detected only by a teacher who has made intensive observation his second nature. And the final consequence of overtaxing a child's memory could eventually lead to a retardation of his growing forces. Somehow even the physical growth of such a child can become affected. Here you have an example showing how soul and spirit interact with what is physical. It can teach us how important it is for the teacher to know how to deal with children's tendencies toward health and sickness. Of course, actual illnesses have to be treated by medical doctors, but the educator is always confronted by inherent trends toward health or sickness in the child. These he should learn to recognize. He should also be aware of how illnesses breaking out in later life often can be traced back to what has happened at school. Knowledge of these facts would make a teacher become far more circumspect in choosing his methods of teaching. In the instance quoted, he certainly would avoid too much stress on the pupil's faculty of remembering. Then he might see a healthier complexion return to the child's face again. He could bring about such a change by showing his pupil something beautiful which would give him pleasure. The next day he might show him again something beautiful or something of a similar kind, which is like a variation of the previous object, in this way bypassing mere memory. Now, a teacher may also discover opposite symptoms in a child. At a certain time, he may notice a boy or girl whose face appears permanently flushed, even if only very slightly. He may find that this change of color is not at all due to any feelings of shame, but that it manifests a shift in the conditions of the health. Again, this symptom may be so slight that it would only be detected by a perceptive teacher. Again, this condition could have many other causes, which, however, would not escape his notice either. It could well be that the tendency to blush was the result of the teacher not appealing sufficiently to the child's faculty of memory. Realizing this, he would try to rectify this condition by giving the pupil more memorizing to do. If left to itself, such an irregularity could become intensified, spreading to the pupil's psyche, where it would manifest in mild but significant outbursts of temper. Such a connection between slackness in memorizing and slight yet unhealthy fits of temper is absolutely possible. More general repercussions of such a condition would be injurious to the pupil's health. The mutual effects between soul and spirit on the one hand and the body on the other, in such a case, could lead to disturbances in breathing and to circulatory troubles. In this way, a teacher, unaware of such links, unwittingly may have implanted in his pupils illnesses which may remain dormant throughout long years of life, and which, triggered off by some additional causes, may finally culminate in serious illnesses. It is for this reason that an educator worthy of the title should know of these connections, characteristic of human nature. As mentioned previously, acute cases of illness have to be dealt with by medical doctors. But during their developmental stages, children are always treading paths leading to either health or illness. The art of education demands that teachers should be conversant with them and able to observe them even in their finer manifestations. In order to illustrate this point even more drastically, I wish to give one more example, which I realize may well be open to challenge, but life presents us with the most manifold situations. Consequently, the case I am going to describe may also be the result of completely different causes. If one lives with what anthroposophy can give to teaching, one grows accustomed to looking around for the most varied causes when confronted with a particular problem. but the following links between symptom and cause could certainly be possible. Let us suppose that a boy or a girl in a class had been following the lessons attentively and to the satisfaction of the teacher. However, one day he or she suddenly appeared somewhat blasé and no longer inclined to pay attention, so that much of the subject matter seemed to pass by unnoticed. Depending on the experience and outlook of the teacher concerned, he might even resort to corporal punishment or other forms of correction in order to bring about greater participation. However, a teacher who is aware of the interplay between spirit and matter, manifesting in health and illness, would follow a completely different line. He might say to the girl or the boy, quote, "You must not let your finger and toenails grow too long. You must cut them more often," close quote. For what expresses itself outwardly as growth, as seen in the growing of finger and toenails, this too is permeated by soul and spirit. And if finger and toenails are allowed to grow too long, these forces of growth become dammed up. Being thus held at bay, they are no longer able to pour themselves into finger and toenails. Such an obstruction to the flow of growing forces, which is removed when the nails are cut, has a similar effect also upon the soul and spiritual counterpart, manifesting in difficulties to concentrate. For the ability to pay attention can be developed only with a free and unlimited flow of life forces which permeate the whole organism. In most cases of this kind, a change in the pupil's powers of concentration may well pass unnoticed. I gave this example in order to show that anthroposophical principles and methods of education by no means neglect the physical aspects of life. They do not lead to a nebulous kind of spirituality, but the spirit is fully taken account of, so that life can be understood and treated appropriately. In this way, an educator who gradually learns to comprehend human nature may gain insight into how to deal rightly with matters pertaining to his pupil's health or illness. The end of Lecture 5.